Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Parliamentary Library for today's Parliamentary Library Lecture. The lectures bring distinguished speakers to the Library to present on important topics of interest relevant to Senators and Members and the work of the Parliament. Today we are looking at tax reform, what it is for and what can it do. And I welcome Professor Miranda Stewart, Director of the Tax and Transfer Policy Institute at the ANU. Tax reform is one of the central public policy issues at the moment, I think, and with the government facing deficits associated with, depending on your perspective, either too much spending, not enough revenue, or a bit of both. The government is holding a national conversation about tax reform, having released a discussion paper and received submissions, and we're now awaiting the tax white paper. So we thought it was an excellent time to invite a distinguished lecturer to talk to us about tax reform. Professor Miranda Stewart is a leading international expert, on tax law and policy, with more than 20 years' experience working at the leading edge of policy research, design and development. She joined ANU from the University of Melbourne, where she was a director of tax studies. She's previously worked in a very diverse career at New York University School of Law in major Australian law firms, at the Australian Tax Office, and has consulted for government. Recent books include, as either co-author or co-editor, Not-for-Profits, the marvellously named Death and Taxes, and the textbook Income, Taxation, Commentary and Materials. Miranda will speak for about 20 to 30 minutes, and then we'll have a question and answer session. So please join me in welcoming Miranda.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks to the Parliamentary Library for this invitation. It's a great pleasure and an honour, and I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet and pay my respects to their elders, past and present. So we seem to be in this era of reform, or at least talking about reform, and the national conversation, as was alluded to. There's a great many potential topics or issues on the reform agenda. So in true academic fashion, I thought I would avoid many of them by going into history for at least part of this talk. But I think there will be time for Q&A, and I will address some of the topical issues that we've got on the agenda. But I'm very happy to hear people's views and respond to questions as well. In the last few weeks, I've had the privilege of speaking to a range of different audiences about tax reform issues. They range from tax specialists, Queensland, Victoria, people who practice in the field, to government officials, the Victorian Department of the Treasury, students in global finance courses who are interested in challenges of multinationals and corporate tax in a global economy. The Prosper Society, some of you may know, used to be known as the Henry George Society, where the single taxes, this land tax proponents, which is a society that goes back many, many years to the last quarter of the 19th century in Australia. Some of these audience are tax enthusiasts and some of them are not, I have to say, but most of us, I guess, see that there is some... are interacting in different ways with the system, I guess, either as taxpayers or advisors or as policymakers. So what I'd like to do is this question of what is tax reform and what can we expect tax reform to achieve. Before getting into that, I'd like to just take a step back and think about what's the purpose of taxes altogether. Of course, everyone has a view on that, because that then may tell us what we might expect to achieve with something that we might call a tax reform. So, of course, taxes are like plumbing. They're not an end in themselves. Even those like me who seem to have spent a career thinking about these questions know that taxes are not an end in themselves. They are a means to fund collective action, if you like. Collective resource decision-making in our community to connect private resource production economic activity with a public or a shared community endeavour. And we do that through our political structure, of course, standing here in the Parliament. It's precisely because of that social and political organisation for the common good that we have taxation. Of course, that's not a new insight. Adam Smith, writing 250 years ago, did ask that question, why do we have taxes at all? And he spent quite a bit of The Wealth of Nations, published in 1776, quite a bit of his last book of that very large set of writings, thinking about why we should fund government and why taxation is the best means to do that. He said that government, for what he saw as a great and civilised nation, he had quite a forward-thinking view about what government should be. He said tax provides that sure, steady and permanent revenue, which alone can give security and dignity to government for a great nation. He again talked about a great and civilised state that must be defrayed by taxes of one kind or another, the people contributing a part of their own private revenue to make up a public revenue to the sovereign. He considered a range of other ways to finance government, as at that time governments still did use a range of other ways. They used the domain, the sovereign actually owning resources and exploiting resources for itself. Of course, borrowing, which we know continues as a core way to fund government, seigneurage, the inflation tax, the control of currency to raise revenue for government. But Adam Smith decided, and I think we still operate in this paradigm, that none of these other sources of revenue are sufficient, to fund what we think government should do today. Now, he was operating not in a democratic context, of course, although with a parliament that the English saw as important. But he also saw the need for taxes to fund public goods. And, of course, that notion of public benefit, using taxes to fund public benefit has a very long history. But he specifically identified public goods, even as far back as 1776, as being those goods that individuals would not sufficiently invest in for themselves. And he included, for example, free primary education as an important public good in 1776, where the children of the wealthy were educated and the children of the poor were not. He saw this public good as critical to the economic development of the nation, so that the economic growth and the market economy that he was so supportive of was intertwined with the public investment. Okay, so I don't want to labour the point excessively, but if we go forward and think about Australia 100 years later, in 1854, we have this strong link in the Eureka Stockade Rebellion between taxes and representation and legitimate government. In fact, the first paragraph, you can find the statement of the rebels of the Eureka Stockade online in various places, but the first paragraph said that every citizen should have a voice in the law, that taxation without representation is tyranny. So those ideas also have a very long history in Australia. And again, I just want to make that link with political democracy one more time, that the High Court decided in 1911 a case called the Osborne case, which was about the federal land tax. So we had federation in 1901. Of course, we had a suite of taxes began to be established in that first decade, or it was 2 decades of federation at the Commonwealth level. One of those was a progressive Commonwealth land tax. No longer exists, but certainly from an economic policy perspective, land tax and reform of land tax is again on the agenda today. In the Osborne case, the reason I want to refer to it is it just reminds us that it is the Parliament that has sovereignty over taxation. We have to remember that although none of us like taxes, in a way it's because we don't like taxes that we have that important link to politics and decision-making. The High Court said in Osborne that even if taxes were oppressive or actually caused destruction of an industry, you know, more or less took the full return from certain economic activities, that they would be constitutionally valid because the Parliament has sovereignty in this regard, supremacy in this regard. So I want to encourage the Parliament not to give up its sovereignty in taxation and to take seriously that agenda at the Commonwealth level. I had a timer and I failed to start it, so for effective speech making. I'll keep an eye on the clock up there. There's one other historical thing that I would like to point to before getting to the contemporary agenda. There has been a lot of discussion in the current policy debate about the role of the income tax. And so I think it is important to just have a slightly longer look at the role of that tax in our contemporary system. Historically and up to today. And then we can think about what would it mean to say, for example, that we should change the tax mix away from income tax. What do we actually mean by that, and what might the goals be? And is that really, to be honest, a good idea? So this year is the centenary of Australia's Commonwealth income tax. It was legislated in 1915. We've also been commemorating the centenary of Anzac Day this year. I must say I feel that the income tax made a greater contribution to the building of the nation than all those millions of lives that were lost in World War I. But anyway, both of them were important in forming the nation. But the income tax was introduced under Billy Hughes. He was then Attorney General at that particular time, of course, had been leader at other times, under Prime Minister Fisher, and it was passed with bipartisan support. It did help, and when you think about the tax reform debate today, it did help that they had just had a double dissolution and an election which led to control of both houses of Parliament by the government. That certainly helped in the passage of tax reform, in particular in the introducing of a new tax which would raise revenue. In fact, the income tax, as Dr. Julie Smith has shown in her brief and very readable history, the income tax is one of a suite of federal taxes that were enacted around about that time. The progressive land tax in 1910, estates duty 1914, and entertainments tax in 1916. Only the income tax has survived, actually, in its form as was enacted at that time, although with much reform. It was described as a courageous effort by the Australian legislature, by economists who were watching from Europe. However, it is worth pointing to some of the statements of the MPs at the time of its introduction. On the opposite side of the House, as I said, it was passed with bipartisan support. But there were concerns. There was a sense that the Commonwealth was blazing a track, as the Leader of the Opposition said, and we're doing this rather hastily. Mr. W. Elliot Johnson, MP, I'm not sure if people are aware of him, he said, quite presciently, I have to say, that unfortunately there is all too much reason to believe that this taxation will not end with the war. And I have to go on. He proceeded to say, to me, it seems only part of a policy of frightfulness in taxation, for which the war is made the excuse by the honourable members opposite. I have not heard in recent debates the phrase frightfulness of taxation, but I hope very much that this phrase will return to the political and policy debate. So, of course, it was introduced at a time of war. The government had a deficit. Does that sound familiar? You know, there was a sense that revenue had to be raised, but it was also critically the beginnings with the land tax of funding Australia's welfare state. And in fact, one of the key drivers for support of federation 15 years earlier, had been a call for an age pension. We need to be cognizant of this trajectory of the taxes funding that benefit. So We talked today about this question of perhaps some policy documents suggest excessive reliance on income tax. It is certainly true that the income tax grew and that it does raise the lion's share of our government revenue today. At the time of Federation, less than 10% of revenues came from any income taxes at the state level or the federal. But as we move through the century, by the time we get to last year's budget, we have a personal income tax with fringe benefits and superannuation taxes raising about $173 billion, company income tax raising about $68 billion, and together about 70% of federal tax revenue and nearly six times the revenue raised by the goods and services tax. Australia would, however, look very different. That history would look very different without the income tax, that history of the way that the nation, the public goods and the welfare state have developed. Those income tax revenues today are enough to fund fully our cash transfer, social security and welfare system, defence and federal government expenditure on health in the current budget. Okay, so if we turn with that context, we've also always had throughout more than a century now of a federated nation, a very stable and resilient federated nation. We've also always had indirect taxation, and in fact it has become less important over time, primarily because we've become an open economy. We hardly collect any revenue from tariffs anymore, whereas at Federation, the lion's share of revenue was tariffs and excise. So economists would all say that has moved us towards a very efficient and growing economy to move away from that indirect tax. What we see today, though, is that the GST merely just updated 15 years ago that share of indirect taxation in Australia. And in fact, our current share of income of indirect tax as a share of the total tax collected has actually been declining since the GST was introduced. So we have this very large core tax base, which is our personal income tax base and our company tax base. And then we have a smaller but still very important tax, the GST, which is actually becoming a little less effective over these decades in terms of the share of consumption that it touches and the share of consumption that other indirect taxes touch. We're smoking less. That's presumably a good thing, but it does mean tobacco revenues are less, for example. So when we talk about tax reform as a whole, what are we trying to achieve? What might we possibly achieve given this context? Well, of course, the main purpose is still to raise taxes, to fund expenditures that the public wants. So you still have to maintain that connection, and we do have this deficit, right? We do have a current and also a structural deficit. At the moment, although it's unpopular to say so, our income tax on current trajectory will help us get out of that deficit position. Because the income tax operates automatically to increase revenue as growth and inflation increase. We don't collect a lot of tax as a government from seigneurage, from control of the currency anymore, but we do have that small inflationary element in the income tax, as well as an element which would increase the tax collected from wage earners as their real salaries rise, and that pushes them up into the next tax bracket or into the next marginal tax rate in a progressive tax structure. So bracket creep is unpopular. It sounds terrible, something creeping along behind you. And Australia has historically, every few years, returned a bracket creep through changes in tax thresholds in the personal income tax to personal income taxpayers. And it may be that we're coming to a time when we might want to do that again. That's a decision for the Parliament. But the Parliament should also be cognizant of the fact that this income tax is doing the job that it has done for the last century growing with the economy in order to support the expenditures of government and ensure that we don't move into deficit. So if we were interested in returning some bracket cut or reducing income taxes in some way, but somehow nonetheless addressing the deficit, these are some of the proposals that are on the table at the moment. What would be some principles that might guide us in that decision-making about what to do with this tax system? So the principles that Adam Smith had developed and that remain, you know, really generally referred to 250 years later in most tax policy debates, concepts of efficiency, equity. He used the concept of certainty in taxation. And in 1776, what he meant by certainty was not tyrannical and coercive collection, because he was very worried about coercive and tyrannical government and government officials. So certainty meant that as a taxpayer you knew what you owed and it was clear and transparent. We now talk about concepts of simplicity or administrability of tax systems. We want to lower the cost of collection as much as possible for the administrator and for the taxpayers themselves. Another concept that I have been using in my role as director of the Tax and Transfer Policy Institute has a slightly longer vision, and you can see that I sort of take that longer vision into the past, but also trying to understand what the tax system should be delivering in the longer term in the future. And that is a concept of resilience of the system. I just thought I might say a couple of words about efficiency, the economic notion of efficiency, and then the concept of resilience, which I take out of a sort of ecological systems theory, and these two aspects of the tax system. So the efficiency idea, of course, is that all taxes impose a wedge between the pre-tax return, the market return from an activity, and the post-tax return. They reduce the return to the worker or investor. Therefore, they are argued to generate disincentives for people to work or invest. The efficiency issue is that there may be less supply then either of the particular good in the market or of the work. That will generate a deadweight loss. There is a compromise reached, a compromise price, if you like, after tax between the supplier and the purchaser. Usually, this basic economic theory is presented in a very simple model with one good and a change in supply and demand affected by the tax. One of the key things to think about with economic thinking about efficiency of taxes is that it is always aimed at optimising supply. Optimising the supply and demand given that we have to have a tax. And so it always has this idea of the single most efficient outcome is what's the goal of optimal tax theory. I just want to contrast that with a concept of resilience. So system resilience, this has come out of ecological or environmental policy and theory, but the idea is that a system may be stable, so an ecological system, but if it is subject to sufficient stresses from the outside, risks or stresses, that may actually push the system into a new state. The previous system becomes unsustainable. The example, the metaphor that systems theorists often use is a ball in a bowl. So, you know, the bowl moves around, the ball stays in the bowl, the system is relatively stable, but if there is enough of a shock, the ball falls out and the system becomes unstable. The example given ecologically is salinity in the soil. Once salt reaches a certain level, 2 metres below the surface, it's too late. Right, that salt is drawn up to the surface through capillary action and the ecological system is completely changed. So we've talked about resilience in the concept of financial markets. After the global financial crisis, can we make sure that our global financial markets, our banking markets, are sufficiently resilient? It's also been used in the context of housing markets. Can we prevent booms and busts? How can we protect people and ensure that housing markets are stable? So if we think about the tax system and resilience, in the longer term, we want to make sure that our core tax bases do continue to generate adequate revenue whilst allowing people to adapt and operate in terms of changes. So if we just think of a couple of examples of this issue of efficiency and resilience in our system, one might be Australia in a global economy. There's a lot of debate at the moment about the role of the company tax. Company income tax, our company income tax rate is 30%. There's a concern that that rate is too high relative to our near neighbours in the region. And also, well, that wasn't my phone, please to say. Relative to our neighbours in the region, relative even to other countries that we look to for policy, for example, the United Kingdom, which is dramatically reducing its company tax rate down to 20% to 18% by 2020. It is argued, and Treasury modelling suggests, don't forget that modelling is based just on that idea of optimising investment in the market. It is argued that if we lowered that company tax rate, we would increase marginal foreign investment, potentially into the country. That, of course, potentially then enhances jobs and growth domestically, which is important. Productivity seems to be primarily driven by the combination of capital with labour and other sources of production, and so that foreign capital investment may be important. On the other hand, there are some strong differences between our company tax system and that of many other countries. We have a dividend imputation system whereby we give back to shareholders about half of company tax that is collected, more or less. So we collect about $68 billion. We give back in franking credits to individual super funds, the corporates, about half of that. So our kind of real tax collection from the company is only half what it appears to be. It still might be that that rate looks high. What we don't know, we know a little bit about what drives foreign investment and the role of tax rates. Tax rates are a part of that investment decision-making process. It might be, therefore, that that marginal rate needs to come down a bit. But I would be very reluctant to see us give up our domestic imputation system at this point, given the success that we have in collecting revenue through the corporate vehicle as an agent for our domestic investment. We should also remember that that company income tax collects a great deal of revenue from resources and other production that is locally generated and tied to Australia. And if we were to reduce that, then unless we introduce another way of capturing that that rent or value in Australia, we will lose the tax on that. So we just need to be aware that if we are worried about the corporate tax rate in the global economy because we think investment is going elsewhere, that's mobile investment we're talking about. How might that affect our domestic tax system, the role of the company tax in backing up our personal income tax domestically and domestic rents and resource collection? In the longer term, though, there is potentially a real issue in the sense that value is being shifted, and the trendy phrase is not only globalisation but digital disruption, the digital economy. Value, even among resources companies, is being shifted into intangible assets, intellectual property, technology, patents, and so on. In fact, it's been estimated by some that even as much as half of the value of some resource companies is in intangibles, not in tangible assets. So the challenge there is that that value is highly mobile. And it is more likely that that value may be located in other countries. One thing to say about that efficiency modelling, though, is that it assumes that Australia does not cooperate with other countries. Rather, it assumes that every country is competitive on its own. Australia has always operated in various other policy areas in cooperation with other countries, of course with more or less success at different times. But one thing that we need to think very hard about in this globalisation debate is to what extent can we protect Australia's national position and our national sort of common good by cooperating with other countries to make sure that each country might be able to collect a fair share of that corporate revenue. In terms of, I might just give one or two other examples and then I'll open up for questions. There's a whole lot of stuff I realise I'm not covering. It's just impossible to cover everything. But I might give one or two other examples. In fact, before I do that, I might go back. Always take refuge in history. I might go back to Billy Hughes because I've just been talking about the corporate tax and the importance of thinking about designing a tax to support prosperity. When he introduced the income tax, Billy Hughes gave quite a good speech, actually. Of course, it's in hindsight, quite a thoughtful speech. He pointed out, first of all, that although it was being introduced in a time of war, he had always regarded this form of direct taxation as peculiarly appropriate to the circumstances of a moderate community. I like that phrase, a moderate community. I like it in 2015, just as much as he liked it in 1915, in terms of describing Australia. Not only as an effective means of raising money for the conduct of government, but serving as an instrument of social reform. So that's the sort of ability to pay fairness aspect of the personal income tax. And I might come back to that. But the particular bit of the speech I'm interested in is what he said about enterprise. He said, nonetheless, it's necessary to consider not merely the requirements of the revenue, but also the incidence of the tax so that the economic equilibrium may be disturbed as little as possible. That's where he's talking about efficiency. Australia is a very rich country, her production per capita being very great, perhaps the greatest in the world. A country's productivity is the measure of its labour force, its energy and its resources. The productivity of labour depends on the amount of capital available and the manner in which it is being used and the efficiency of the labour. So, I mean, that could be said today. You might wonder if anything has changed in 100 years of economics, but that might be another question. Maybe we still don't understand really how the economy operates. But what he says is, at this juncture, it is of the utmost importance that we shall do nothing to discourage enterprise. And, in fact, it is quite interesting to think about how the original 1915 income tax applied to corporations. It treated them as more or less transparent. So where profits were distributed out to shareholders, a deduction was allowed to the company, and they were taxable in the hands of the shareholders, up to a rate of 60% at the top end. The company itself, the reinvested profits, were taxed at a rate that was effectively only about 7.5%. So he did design. They did design a corporate tax system that actually saw the corporation as an agent for the shareholders, trying to make sure that there was going to be some tax at the shareholder level, at the investor level, but that there would be a lower tax on the actual investment itself, the enterprise itself. The last thing I thought I might say, just sort of in this area, to think about. Enterprise taxation, seems that's where I have gone. The other thing that's very much on the political agenda at the moment is under our former Prime Minister, the treatment of small business, and still an important issue with the Assistant Treasurer having that role, and also the issue of innovation and entrepreneurship. And I guess I just do want to say a couple of different things about that. One is that, again, it would appear that taxes get in the way You know, that's the general knowledge. Somehow taxes get in the way of entrepreneurship. They impose that wedge, don't they, between the before tax and the after tax return. Empirically, however, it is still very unclear if taxes really drive behaviour in the entrepreneurship area, just as it is really unclear if, statistically speaking, taxes are really driving people offshore, individuals offshore, to be in other countries. And I think we need to be mindful of how we might design tax reforms to encourage entrepreneurship. We have now this lower company tax rate, 28.5% for businesses under 2 million turnover. That is a kind of an odd policy, I have to say. I don't think that policy really supports entrepreneurship, meaning growth businesses. That policy applies to all small businesses, which is most of them. And as we know, mostly they are owned and invested in domestically, and we have a dividend imputation system. And in any event, what that allows is a little bit of deferral of tax for reinvestment, but, you know, not much, right? The difference between 8.5 and 30 is not great. So that's a very marginal and possibly just a complicating measure. We also already have in our system a lower rate for capital gains. We have lower rates for certain kinds of venture capital partnership. We have exemptions for capital gains of foreign residents investing into the country. So where are we going to do these measures to support entrepreneurship? Now, one way is actually to provide that upfront support which enables access to losses. We've done this with exploration companies. We actually give a credit or to the investor in respect of the expenditure put upfront into a startup. And another way that we've already seen is to reward work to enable workers to be rewarded at a lower tax rate. But I guess we've been trying to subsidise venture capital in this country for at least 20 years, if not longer. And in fact, as you saw from Billy Hughes' speech, the concern goes back 100 years. The evidence of everything we've done to date is that it has had a marginal effect, if any, I would have to say. So I guess my question is whether the tax measures themselves are going to have that effect. What can we actually achieve with a reform that is aimed at entrepreneurship? And on the other side, we need to make sure that we protect the resilience of that company tax and personal income tax system and not drill a whole lot of holes in it. So let's like called it Swiss cheese, with good reason already, in terms of its longer-term viability for that core role of raising revenue. So, look, I'm conscious of the time, and I realise I've only touched on a few issues, but I think it might be best to do Q&A if that's...
Thanks, Miranda. Any questions for Miranda?
Thanks very much. There's been an increasing media attention on the impact of our current tax settings on women in particular. How do you think this debate is going to develop in the next few years?
Or will we see any change? We're just going to keep debating. The national conversation continues. So there's been a few different aspects, I suppose. One is about women and work. And the concern, which is linked to economic growth, that actually we have a large chunk of our educated and skilled labour force that is still not fully working in the market. That's not to say that women are not working, right? So no one would say that. And there's a question of where's the best value. But in terms of returning measurable economic growth and also tax revenues, that participation in paid work is critical. And also for women's individual longer term, their own economic resilience, if you like. Ironically, a progressive personal income tax based on the individual is one of the most effective tools we have to encourage female labour force participation. Because at lower levels of income, where secondary earners often are, who have higher elasticity, higher responsiveness to tax rates, they face lower tax rates. Right? So on its own, the personal income tax is pretty well designed. The challenges that we are seeing where women are moving into part-time work, but statistically, of course, not moving into full-time work, to the extent that we have policy settings that are affecting that, it's in the transfer system. It's the combination of the tax system and the transfer system, and I know that the Minister for Social Services and the Treasurer have just announced an interdepartmental working group. I do hope the two departments of the Treasury and DSS actually do talk to each other. I hope they did before this, but maybe that working group will make it easier. It's the combination, the piling on top of the personal rate structure with the childcare cost, the withdrawal of benefits for families, and so on, which are tested on a household joint basis. Having said that, and I do think the tax transfer system does cause impediments and is a deterrent for some female workforce participation, there is a lot else going on as well in terms of women's behaviour, individuals' behaviour generally, and the availability of childcare rather than its cost might be a key issue, for example, the existence of social norms and, to be honest, the lack of good jobs. In some places might be what's causing that problem. But certainly it's that tax transfer interaction. The other area where, for gender, the issue's been really on the agenda has been about superannuation, of course. You know, one of the reasons superannuation is so problematic for women is that it is tied to workforce participation. We've moved in our retirement system away from a universal but means-tested age pension for most people's retirement to a work insurance model of retirement provision in our superannuation system. And as soon as we do that, then anyone who is not fully attached to the workforce over their life course is disadvantaged. So there are lots of discussions about how that might be dealt with. Really, in my view, the best way would be to reduce the concessional nature of that system at the top end. That's not a direct measure for women, right? And to use that revenue in productive ways to sort of reduce the effective marginal tax rates women are facing at the bottom end, or more broadly in public expenditure that would have that broader gender benefit. So that would be my suggestion. Yeah.
You haven't said much or anything about state taxes and the tax bases that are available to states.
Yes.
The very interesting topic of vertical fiscal imbalance.
Yes.
What reforms do you see potential in that space?
So, I actually think state tax reform is really important, and the challenge is how do we engage with that at a Commonwealth level? You know, how do you engage here? From an efficiency or prosperity perspective, that Treasury modelling, of course, that suggests that company income tax is a bit less efficient than other taxes, suggests that the most inefficient taxes are stamp duties and taxes on insurance. Of course, we also know they're delivering quite a lot of bang for the buck, at least in the wealthy states of New South Wales and Victoria at the moment. That stamp duty land tax switch, as it is often called, that would be a tax mix switch where we don't reduce property taxation. In fact, we might seek over time to increase the share of property taxation in the overall tax tally. There is pretty much universal consensus that that would be a good thing for the economy, right? Good thing in terms of freeing up capital and workers and improving cities and potentially encouraging access to, for example, the housing market. So the challenge there is a political economy one. It's interesting to go back again to 1915. So the states all had land taxes of different kinds, but in 1910, the Commonwealth introduced a progressive land tax and stopped that some decades later. It is in the power of this Parliament to enact any kind of tax that it considers appropriate, of course. Now, I'm in favour of actually strengthening our state governments, but to me that's a national project. So that requires Commonwealth support and coercion in order to actually strengthen the state governance. So one carrot, if you like, might be that in some sort of national tax deal that might also involve the GST, but in some sort of national tax deal, the Commonwealth says that it will provide funding support for the transition from a stamp duty system to a land tax system. I mean, though you're living in the ACT, you know that the ACT has done that transition, started that long transition. It's politically costly. People see their rates bills go up and it doesn't look good, even though property prices when you buy may well be a bit lower. You don't have that stamp duty impost when you actually buy a property. So I would like to see that change. I'd actually like to see a national harmonised land tax base, but at the state level. So it can be nationally harmonised, but the land tax revenues go to the state. And I think the Commonwealth might need to support that reform. I have to say I don't see a lot of political appetite for it. That's been the case for several decades.
So just picking up on talking about state taxes.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work in that sort of indicated that some of those transactional taxes, like stamp dues, are highly inefficient and costly. Is it not also true that state governments hold the tools, some very efficient tools that they just use poorly in taxation? They have a tax that is no necessarily better or worse than the GST or a labour tax in an efficiency sense in payroll taxes, but through the lack of harmony in the implementation of those taxes across states, the carve-outs that they've provided, they've effectively corrupted the one genuinely efficient tax base they have. And I guess that leads into my second point, which was, if we do a land tax on a national front, would your thinking be that it had to be, like the GST, a tax that the federal government collects and then distributes to the states? Because the inevitability of having a harmonised land tax administered by states would be that over time it wouldn't be harmonised. It would inevitably, political pressures would cause it to be different from jurisdiction.
It's interesting. I mean, we have... I'll come back to your payroll tax point. But we have joint national state governance of the GST in that intergovernmental agreement. I was pretty sceptical, I must say, that, there it is still, 15 years later. Of course, it is a Commonwealth tax, though, just as you point out, that tax was enacted at the Commonwealth level. I do wonder whether building in joint governance of those other two, of the consumption and land bases, if you like, we've sort of got it already for the GST, and in some way doing that with the land tax. I would prefer it to be collected at the state level because I think that we already have local government collection of rates, and so I'm not really in favour of centralising all of that. We have some systems already that are moderately effective at the state level there. The question is how you design a base that stays stable. One way is to constantly have a carrot stick. Well, if you move away from the base, you lose something in the federal quid pro quo somehow over time. In terms of payroll, I agree. I mean, the states have competed away some of the payroll tax base. And one idea I've floated, and it's very easy to float ideas in this space without fully implementing or thinking through, is that we were to... What would happen if we were to move to a national... a national payroll tax base, but at the state level, on the full wage base. But in this case, I would suggest collected on the pay-as-you-go wage withholding. So using digital technologies to actually have a joint collection base of that payroll tax. One possibility is that we rebadge the Medicare levy as that payroll tax, replace the existing state payroll taxes, move the Medicare levy and have a flat uniform wage base Medicare levy. So everyone would contribute something to the funding of hospitals. Look, I think it would be valuable, it's valuable for Australia to have effective democracies at the state level. But it shouldn't surprise us that state governments compete with each other. You know, they're operating in a national market for investment and building of factories. It's not at all surprising that they are competing. And what we need to remember is that the benefits of reform, so that if the benefits of Victoria reforming, for example, broadening and flattening its payroll tax, which is not bad actually in Victoria, and also its land tax, those benefits flow nationally, right? To the extent that those benefits move into generate economic growth, higher income tax collections will go to the federal government, higher GST collections will go to all the states on an equalised basis. So the benefits of state tax reform are shared nationally, but the political cost is borne entirely by the state. It's easy to say the states are not using their tools available to them, but they do bear all the political costs and they do not see all the economic benefit of a tax reform at the state level.
One here and then probably the last one here.
Thanks for your talk, Miranda. You've spoken a lot about the history of implementing of taxation, and you spoke about it being the income tax first being introduced in World War One. We've seen at times of crisis the ability for governments to implement new taxes.
Yeah.
Why has tax reform failed in Australia? Why have governments failed to introduce new taxes? We've seen that in the last decade.
So, of course, there was a war on, and we know that there was lots of change in World War II. It doesn't have to take a war, and war is not the only driver. As I said, there was a majority in both houses, and John Howard had a majority, you know, but a much reduced majority when he finally negotiated the GST. If any government could get a majority in both houses, then it would be good to see if it could achieve tax reform, although that might then make it look too easy. You know, there's an interesting question as to whether we have a crisis, a fiscal crisis. So clearly we have a deficit, and as I said, we have a deficit going out a number of years, and we also have population ageing and those longer-term trends. Joseph Schumpeter, a well-known economist who also wrote about entrepreneurship and creative destruction, was very concerned about a crisis of the tax state in 1917. In fact, he coined that term. And what he was worried about was that government taxes would not be sufficient to fund... He wasn't worried about war or debt. He was worried about social welfare, that actually the needs that the public wanted... could not be funded with taxes, so that would cause the destruction of the state, if you like. Turns out he was wrong through the 20th century because we managed to build tax systems that delivered what people want. So in terms of success of tax reform, I think you still need to understand what is it that the population actually wants. You know, do people want... Raising taxes is very difficult unless you're delivering public goods. And so we talk about the GST rather superficially in this debate, as if we could just easily raise it. There's no doubt if we raise the GST one way or another, we would increase revenue. You know, it does have that capacity. But I can't see the population accepting that unless government says that it's going to deliver the public services and goods with that increased revenue rather than just cutting other tax rates. You've asked me the question that really I tend to say that politicians have, but I think what we need to understand is linking that tax raising to public expenditure and what is it that actually the public wants to do with the revenue.
And last question, I think we're going to have
thanks, Miranda, and thanks for acknowledging my tax history book.
That's right.
I've got two questions, I suppose. One follows on from this last point about sustainability, I suppose, the resilience of the tax system and taxpayer acceptance of it, because the income tax is fundamentally a voluntary tax, and if people really don't believe that government should be collecting the money, they'll avoid it. We need to have the cultural acceptance. So would you like to elaborate firstly on the links between that linking of income taxation with social security measures such as the age pensions linked with the federal land tax and income tax, child endowment was linked with the payroll tax in the 40s, and so on. And so that earmarking or linking, whether it's formal hypothecation or not, and public acceptability and sustainability of the tax. So that's the first thing. The second thing you mentioned was the decline in indirect tax rates over the century.
Collections, as a proportion.
Sorry,
of
collections. And revenues.
Revenues.
And a big part of that was not the erosion of the base, but actually the liberalisation of trade over the past 50 years. And you emphasise the need for parliaments to maintain their sovereignty over taxation. I wonder if you'd like to comment on that in terms of trade treaties, because we've tended to lose that focus on tariffs as revenue. And if we're at the point of saying, well, for efficiency gains, economic efficiency gains, we need to be slashing the income tax, then maybe we need to be comparing the cost of the marginal dollar.
And a question and an answer in a couple of minutes.
A couple of minutes. Everybody has a lot to do. I know it's a sitting week. The first question about earmarking. So Australia does not... Some countries have very strong earmarking of tax revenues to particular public expenditures. In some ways, we have done that in a privatised kind of way with superannuation. So we have constructed a private but very expensively publicly supported retirement system which is earmarked to your contributions and the earnings that happen on your sort of private thing, and then you get your payment out of it. But we have that age pension as a backup, and we talk about the Medicare levy, but of course you would know that the hospitals are funded out of public consolidated revenue, and the Medicare levy is not earmarked as such. From a budgeting perspective, earmarking is... It can be a problem because you can be earmarking either too much or too little revenue to the policy goal. And there are some advantages in broad-based taxes, and I would put the income tax and the GST, it actually could do with some broadening, but into that category in order to fund broad public expenditure. And that keeps the government nimble, I think, and able to change some of those decisions about public expenditures over time. So I'm not a fan of tight earmarking, but I think in the public debate, earmarking taxes to the benefit of government is critical. So the public needs to understand they will get better services as a result of higher taxes. That's really important. And if they have lower taxes, they may not understand that that means less services from the public. I don't think I can answer your question on trade. I certainly don't hold myself out as an expert on trade. But I think the reality is that we do not use tariffs and those sorts of indirect tax to raise revenue anymore. We did a century ago. And so we need to think of these domestic broad-based taxes, and our income tax is really still a really critical part of that revenue base.
Thank you very much. You. On that note... thank you all very much for coming. Great to see you all. And please join me in thanking Professor Miranda Stewart.
Thank you.